Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars from right here in dead center in the vast liberal conspiracy, the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome to our show today. The quote for the day. Our quote for the day, this is brilliant. This is from the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Governor Howard Dean. He said this on April 19th, just a few days ago. He said, these machines, speaking of voting machines, these machines are a problem. This is not some internet conspiracy. This is a serious problem that faces American democracy. These machines are not reliable, and they shouldn't be used. We should not be using machines in this country where the results of the vote cannot be verified after the fact. Period. Any machines. End of quote. Our quote for the day from DNC Chairman Governor Howard Dean. Said it out loud on the 19th of April. Welcome to our program. Coming up on today's program, Congressman Jim McDermott will be here in our second hour. He's representing Washington's 7th Congressional District and wants to talk about taxpayer privacy. Should the IRS allow tax preparers to sell off our private information? Might it even already be going on? A question for this hour, do we need a second revolution to revive democracy in the United States of America? With us is Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. The website, Yaron is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back here with us.
Absolutely.
You suggest in this op-ed piece that you wrote, Mob Rule Wins in France, that, I'll just quote your opening sentence, France has subjugated itself to mob rule by withdrawing proposed legislation that would have granted French employers slightly more freedom to hire and fire employees. And what is the mob rule?
Well, the mob rule is that the French legislature passed a law, the president signed that law, and as a consequence of riots and demonstrations and threats of strikes in the streets of Paris, the law was rescinded. The legislature, the president, the government capitulated to the mobs in the streets and backed away from this legislation.
Well, first of all, they only partly backed away from it, did they not? Just for the sake of news accuracy here.
Well, they parted away from those parts of the law that were most objectionable. But last I read, they were back to negotiating, I guess, with the unions and the
right.
students about other parts of the law. Because what happens when you back down to the mob, to intimidation broadly, is that those who intimidate learn from that, and that they can then expand and demand more. And that's exactly what happened here. The day after the government said they were going to rescind those parts of the law, the unions and the students came back and said, well, actually, we've got more objections. We should talk about them. So what the final outcome is going to be, I think, is yet to be determined.
So if we live in a nation where 51% of the people say, we should have laws that say that employers, if they're going to fire an employee, have to give that employee 3 weeks' notice. So they have to, for example, in France, the rule, I believe, is that they have to pay them the equivalent of 1 week's salary for each year worked for the first 10 years, and then like a month's salary for every year after that or something like that. I mean, it's fairly substantial severance pay by American standards. If 51% of the people in the country say, yes, that's how we want it to be, you consider that mob rule? Most of us would consider that democracy.
Well, a couple of things. That's not what happened in France. 51% of the people were not asked. A minority of people demonstrated in the streets, certainly not 51% of the French people demonstrated. I don't think polls yet count as elections, and therefore even if the polls showed that 51% object, the French people have the ability, just like in any other democratic country, to go to the polls during election time and vote a different government in. But you can't vote a government in and then, when it does something you don't like, riot and demonstrate in the street and have the government just capitulate, because then those people who are out in the street are dictating policy, not the voters. The voters actually voted for, I can't say, Vilprin or whatever, however you pronounce his name, to be prime minister.
Right.
He made a particular decision, and that should hold. If in the next election the electorate doesn't like it, it's completely legitimate for them to vote him out of office and to vote somebody else in. Now,
two points here, Yaron. The first is that the elected representatives, a majority of the elected representatives, voted in favor of these changes. So, France isn't a pure democracy like Athens, Greece was, any more than the United States is. It's a constitutionally limited democratic republic and representative republic. And so, you had 51% of the people speaking for the people voted for this, or more, number one. And number two, the logic that you're using sounds very much, there's a real deja vu here for me. This is the same logic that I was hearing back in the 1960s from people who were saying, oh, that Martin Luther King, those civil rights protesters, how dare they get out in the streets and try to influence law by asking for a Voting Rights Act?
I have no problem in the people going out into streets as long as they're not destroying property, as long as they're not being vandals, which I think Martin Luther King was very good at not allowing these people to do. They demonstrated peacefully. I'm on all for peaceful demonstrations.
But the people
I object to is the government capitulating to those demonstrations with regard to a law that I think it wasn't a good law because I think it didn't go far enough, but it was a clear improvement for the French, for French life, and for the French people. The difference is that in France there was vandalism, there was violence, there was intimidation, something that I don't think Martin Luther King would have tolerated.
But if you look at an analysis of what happened in France, you find that those people who were the vandals in this were, number one, a very, very small minority, and number two, actually worked against their own cause. I mean, there was a tremendous blowback against the people who were committing acts of vandalism out in the streets, and they were disavowed by the labor movement. They were disavowed by the politicians who were working for workers' rights. I would suggest, Yaron Brook of AyinRand.org, that really what you're objecting to is that France still has a law in the books that protects workers, and you think that the rights of workers, even if the majority of people in a democracy think workers should have rights, you don't think that they should, that the workers should be hired and fired purely at the pleasure of the employer. Isn't that really the bottom line here?
Well, absolutely it's the bottom line. I do think the workers should be fired at the whim of the employer. I think the employer has rights here. And I also think that workers should be allowed to resign at their own whim. I don't think the workers have rights. They can take the job and they can leave a job whenever they want. And same with an employer. They are employment contracts, and those employment contracts can specify certain amount of notice, and they can specify a certain amount of compensation, but it's not the government's job. Indeed, I think it's a violation of rights for the government to butt in here and to dictate to the employers and the employees how they should construct their employment contract.
Well, where does a corporation get the right to do business and hire people from, Yaron? It gets that right from government. That's it's not a negative right. It's a positive right. It's an affirmative right. And so government, representing we the people, can say, fine, you want to run a business in our country? Here's the terms under which you have to run that business. So we have all kinds of parameters within which companies have to operate a business. And one of them in France is you have to treat your employees decently.
But that, of course, is a complete red herring because, corporations don't have different employment laws than private proprietorships or that partnerships do. So the fact is that corporations are not a creation of government. The corporations are creations of the marketplace. And all the government does is protect the property rights of the owners of corporations.
But property rights are a creation of the government.
The owners of self-proprietorships.
Yaron, property rights themselves are a creation of government. You can't have property rights if you don't have police to enforce them, if you don't have laws that define them, if you don't have court systems in which they can be adjudicated, and prisons in which you can put people who violate them.
That is true, but it's not a creation of the government. Governments are created in order for the sole reason, the only reason government should exist, is to protect individual rights, including property rights. It's not a creation of the government. It's a creation.
The government arbitrarily creates what you call property rights. Why shouldn't it just as easily create employment rights?
Well, because employment rights violate the property rights of the owners of that property.
But not having property, not having employment rights violates the work rights of the employees.
There's only one way to violate rights, and that's by using force or fraud. There's no force or fraud initiated by the employer when they contract with an employer.
There is if there are more workers than there are jobs and people are starving.
Well, that's not
you are threatened with the loss of your life.
It's still not force. The fact is,
I would say famine is a very powerful form of force.
What's that?
I would say famine is a very powerful form of force, and it's used all over the world by employers.
It is not the initiation of force, and the government has no business getting involved in the voluntary decisions of individuals.
Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, as always.
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first.
This is Merle Haggard, by the way.
Bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
Absolutely amazing piece of music you can find over at MerleHaggard.com. And if you like country western music, not only is it a great song, but he just takes on Bush. He says, let's get out of Iraq. And at the very end, it's actually a video, you know, a music video. And you can see it at his website, MerleHaggard.com. And at the very end, he says, you think I'm blowing smoke? And I don't remember the exact language he uses. He says, you think I'm blowing smoke? I'm not. He says, I travel coast to coast 26 times a year, something like that. And then he kind of winks at the camera like, you know, you better take this seriously, George, you know. And just a great new piece of music from Merle Haggard. Welcome back to the program. Do we need a second Bill of Rights? Do we need a second revolution in the United States? Cass Sunstein suggests so in a new book called The Second Bill of Rights, FDR's Unfinished Revolution, and which is my independent thinker book of the month on BuzzFlash.com. And this book is grounded in a speech that FDR gave, Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave, on January 11th, 1944. It was his State of the Union address, the last one he gave. He was dead 8-9 months after he gave this speech. And so, because he didn't have an opportunity, he didn't have 4 years to champion his second Bill of Rights. Franklin Roosevelt's, FDR's second Bill of Rights really never got the traction that, frankly, I think it should have and that it deserved. He started out his speech by saying, it is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and determine the strategy for the winning of a lasting peace. This is, you know, as World War II is wrapping up. And the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. Keep in mind, Franklin Roosevelt brought us the golden age of the American middle class. He said, we cannot be content, no matter how high that general standard of living may be, if some fraction of our people, whether it be one-third or one-fifth or one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure. Franklin Roosevelt, in his State of the Union speech, I mean, this was back in the days when presidents were really presidents. When this guy, Franklin Roosevelt, one of the greatest presidents this country has ever had, he went on to say, this republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights, among them the right of free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. As our nation has grown in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness, which, by the way, you find in the Declaration of Independence. Our nation, the first in the history of the world to have the word happiness in its founding document. He said, we have come to a clearer realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Here's Roosevelt tying together the idea of freedom with the idea of economic security. Again, back to his speech. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. Might that be why Bush is presiding intentionally, apparently, over the dramatic increase in joblessness, homelessness, and hunger in the United States? Anyhow, Franklin Roosevelt. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these are, and here's Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights. He said, the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops of farms or mines in the nations. Industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All of these rights, said Franklin Roosevelt in his State of the Union address in 1944, all of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. Franklin Roosevelt laying out a second Bill of Rights, a proposed Bill of Rights. What happened to Franklin Roosevelt's Bill of Rights? Why was he unable to implement it? Aside from the fact that he died, I mean, why didn't the Democratic Party carry this forward? Why wasn't Harry Truman, his vice president, who became president when he died 8 or 9 months after he gave this speech, able to carry forward Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights? And why are Democratic politicians today not talking about it? Coming up after this break, more on FDR's second Bill of Rights and your calls at 866-440-8466. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Who's on the hill and who's watching the valley? Who's in charge of it all?
It's Merle Haggard again.
God bless the Army and God bless our liberty. That gum the rest of it all.
Yeah, gum them all. Here it comes.
In a position of packing away. Freedom's stuck in reverse. Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first.
Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and rebuild America first. I tell you, when you've lost Merle Haggard, you've lost America. Merle Haggard, a brand new song out, you can see it over at merlehaggard.com, Trashing George Bush. And it just blew me away. And I, you know, country music is... You know, I love country music. What can I say? I was first exposed to it when I was 16, going on 17 years old. First job I got as a DJ, a country western DJ, because that was the only job I could find. It was the only station that was hiring. And I was a hardcore rock and roll and Jimi Hendrix and just, you know, the whole right on down the line, what was popular in 1967 and 1968. And I discovered there's some pretty good music in there. And Merle Haggard is a great musician. And they call him the poet of the common man. So I'm telling you, Bush has lost Merle Haggard. He's losing America. This is slipping right through his fingers. Anyhow, what happened with FDR's unfinished revolution? What happened with his second Bill of Rights? Why did it not continue? Really, here's the essence of what happened. starting in 1905, the Supreme Court started ruling against what we would call the rights of workers, as it were, the rights of humans, and in favor of basically the rights of corporations. In 1905, with the famous Lochner case in New York, the Baker's case, where there was a law in New York that said that a baker could not work more than 10 hours a day or 5 days a week. And the Supreme Court struck that down, saying that it was a violation of the right to contract between an employee and an employer. And then they struck down child labor laws, they struck down unemployment laws, they struck down the early iteration of what later became Social Security. The Supreme Court just struck down a whole series of these things, what's sometimes referred to as the Lochner Court, starting in 1905 and going right up to 1937, which was very frustrating for Franklin Roosevelt, who was the president from 32 until 1944. But in 1937, suddenly the Supreme Court started agreeing with Roosevelt. And it's because the American people were agreeing with Roosevelt. They were saying, yes, the right to have, you know, a minimum wage is a right. The right to unemployment insurance should be a right. And what happened was Americans came to say things like, you know, came to conclude that things like public education, even though it's not in the Constitution, is a right. We have decided that. It has become a right in our society. And very few people would argue against that. And Social Security is a right in our society. Very few people would argue against that. I mean, the majority of people are in favor of that. And the majority of people in America, I would say, for example, that health care should be a right. But Franklin Roosevelt, I mean, you know, this is just unambiguous. The right to provide adequate food and clothing, the right to a useful and remunerative job, in other words, good pay, the right for every person who runs a small or large business to be free of unfair competition and domination by monopolies. The right of every family to a decent home, the right to housing, the right to adequate medical care, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, and the right to a good education. Virtually every other fully developed democracy in the world has adopted these rights. In fact, many of them have written them into their constitutions. So why didn't we? Why didn't FDR's revolution get finished? Well, the main reason was a two-step process. The one was in 1946, the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives, and they started blocking legislation that Harry Truman was trying to put through. When Harry Truman, for example, in 47, proposed national health care, they said, no, you can't do it. And in fact, they then pushed through a law, that the Taft-Hartley law, that made it harder to unionize. Truman vetoed it, and they shot down his veto. So part of it was that, but a larger part of it was Nixon. Nixon appointed Rehnquist and two other conservatives to the Supreme Court of the United States. And because from 37 until 73, the Supreme Court, including the after the 37 court, I forget who the guy was who was the Supreme Court justice then, but then along came Earl Warren. Basically, in the Warren Court, they were all on Roosevelt's side. So from 1937 to 1973, the Supreme Court was basically ruling, these things are rights. You do have a right to education, even if you're African-American. I mean, that was the core of Brown versus Board of Education. There is a right to education. So they were slowly implementing FDR's unfinished revolution, his second Bill of Rights. And Nixon appointed Rehnquist and two other conservatives to the court. And starting in the early 70s, the Supreme Court started rolling back those rights, and they've been doing it ever since. So that's the history of it. And I think, frankly, if any Democratic politician wants to win and win big, they need to be, you know, taking on this stuff. They need to be picking up these issues and carrying them forward. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont on the line. Hey, Rama, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm just great. Good old Rama. Rama was the first producer of this national program, just to let everybody know. And back in those days, kind of chief cook and bottle washer, you were answering the phone and producing the show and everything else. And it's great to hear your voice, Rama.
And I got to tell you, that's a proud point of my life to have been there at the beginning and help you get this thing started, because
yeah.
You and Louise have done a great, great job along
thank you.
With everybody
else. Yeah, you literally did help us get this program started. Yeah, I'm
well,
very grateful to you.
Anyway, you'll let me on the air without being too nice to you, right?
Okay, beat me up, Rama.
Well, no, I don't want to, because going back to Euron, who incidentally is a guest who I enjoy listening to, his logic about not giving up to the crowds out on the street kind of has this interesting inverse logic that has to go along with it. And that says, is if these crowds are out in the streets protesting a bad law, you don't get rid of it because the crowds are in the streets, so you keep the bad law. And
this is sort of George Bush's policy with regard to Don Rumsfeld. You know, if generals are calling for him to step down, then he's not going to step down.
That's yeah, exactly. And it leads to an inherent problem that, you know, you just don't listen to the people. What counts is the monarchy. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's just an interesting point that hit my head there.
Good observation, Rama. Thanks a lot. Great
all
to
right,
hear
Tom.
From you.
Stay Bye-bye.
In touch. Cindy in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Cindy, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling about Ohio. The primary is on May 2nd. Dennis Kucinich, one of our most impressive progressive Democrats in Congress,
mm-hmm.
has a challenger whose name is Rebecca Ferris. Many people who've looked at her record referring to her as a Democrat in name only. And there are now developments that are looking to me as if the Ohio GOP is getting ready to steal this election from Kucinich.
He has a primary challenger.
Yes.
Do they have open primaries in Ohio? Can anybody vote in the primary?
Well, you can vote, but you have to vote in your party.
Okay.
Okay.
So are Republicans re-registering as Democrats so they can mess with the election? Is that what's
happening?
Here's
what's happening. Robert Brown has set up an organization called Republicans for Ferris. He's now distributing emails to Republicans asking them to refuse their Republican primary ballots and ask for a Democratic primary ballot so they can vote for Ferris instead of Kucinich.
Oh, my.
So what they wind up doing is, you know, really surrendering their GOP membership and becoming Democrats just for that day.
Yeah. This is an old Republican strategy. You know, Nixon knew that Muskie would beat him.
Uh-huh.
And that's why he sent Charles Colson and the Hit Squad off to New Hampshire to some people say they drugged Muskie's coffee. You know, they stole his letterhead or they forged his letterhead. They wrote this phony letter. He gets up on the back of a flatbed truck and starts crying about his wife, apparently high. And that was it. You know, Nixon then Nixon got to run against McGovern, who he knew he could beat because he knew
right.
he couldn't beat Muskie.
Right.
I mean, the Republicans, they're playing chess, not checkers. They're looking
right.
several moves ahead.
Right, right. Now, hang on, a couple more things. Ferris is running expensive TV ads now, even though at the end of last month she only had $4,500. So some of us are wondering where she's getting the money for these ads, very professionally done.
Yeah.
And not at all least, guess what? May 2nd, Cuyahoga County is rolling out their brand new Diebold electronic touchscreen voting machines.
Very good.
And these machines do have voter verifiable receipt that's kept in the machine. But what most people aren't paying enough attention to is that the voter verifiable ballots are meaningless if we don't have 100% recounts. And my
or at the very least, random recounts of, you know, 3-4%. I mean,
the problem with that, of course, is that there are people from Board of Elections in Ohio right now that are under indictment for having not followed Ohio state law.
That's right,
in
with
regard
to the recounts.
The presidential recounts in 2004.
Yeah,
and
it's amazing.
And if the GOP steals the election and Ferris gets it by 52 or 56 or 64%,
yep.
then it doesn't...
Cindy, I agree with you. It's a terrible situation. And good point, and thank you for the call. Joel in Paris, France. I'm sorry, Joel, we only have 20 seconds left, and I know you're calling from Paris. Quick comment you wanted to make?
Oh, is it Tom?
Yeah, you're live on the air.
Yes, I'm calling because of Yaron Brook and the comments and the France bashing that happens from time to time.
Yeah.
It's the thing I wanted to point out was the hypocrisy of these people who have no problem with democracy being perverted by lobbyists and huge amounts of money that goes into campaign financing and voting machines and all that. And yet, as soon as the people take to the streets to exercise their rights to mobilize and to speak, then it's the mob.
Right. Now, in France, was this a response to mob rule, or was the mob representing the majority opinion, do you think, Joel?
Majority opinion, without a doubt. I spoke with everybody I could about this. And it was, you know, this is the way a government should respond. And the law was passed with no debate, with no discussion. It just appeared all of a sudden. And understandably, the people who would be affected by this were angry about it.
Yeah.
There needs to be a discussion when you have a major change in the code of employment.
Agreed. Joel, thanks so much for calling from Paris, France. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's get out of Iraq, get back on track, and let's rebuild America first.
I'm telling you, you've lost Merle Haggard. You've lost America.
What's wrong?
MerleHaggard.com, you want to hear the whole song. And here comes where he has a special message for Bush, right here at the end.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it the most. You think I'm blowing smoke? Boys, it ain't no joke. I make 20, 50 years coast to coast.
There you go. He knows what's going on in America. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. John in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind today? John, you're live and on the air.
Okay.
What's up?
Hi, how you doing today, Tom? I wasn't listening to the radio till all of a sudden it came on the phone.
Uh-huh.
My point was, what I usually say this in like a 30-second speech for the last 6 years since I've been a truck driver, but Plato warned that any democracy would have to fail. The only way one could succeed is if everybody was equally well-informed, and some of our forefathers read Plato, part of
sure.
the classical education,
yeah.
and between that and the Iroquois Indians, they gave us representatives. These people lived in the neighborhood.
Yep.
You know, our grandfathers knew their grandfathers. We used to know these people and what they stood for.
Yep.
And then I'm reminded that, then originally it was 26,000 people got a representative. And over the years, to keep from building a new congressional building, they watered it down, 180,000, et cetera, et cetera. Today, I believe it's 661,000 people get a representative.
Depending
and I wonder
on the state
how well represented we are.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. On the other hand, if we had a parliament or a house, a legislative body as large as India's, for example, which I believe has around 600 members. I'm not certain it's the largest in the world. It gets kind of unwieldy, but I agree that our Congress is not as representative as it could be. I think, frankly, though, the bigger problem than the number of people who are represented by each representative is the amount of money and how corporations are considered human beings or persons under the law right now, and they weren't when the founding of this country, and how money is considered free speech, and Jefferson would have laughed at that idea.
I know that's right, but I'm wondering now if a lot of people would say we don't need any more laws. Just unfortunately, that would satisfy that crowd. With 30 times the number of representatives, how much would they be able to get done? That didn't need to be done.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say, John, and it's a thought provoking question. I don't have an easy answer for
it. Thank you for your show and your staff, Tom. I really do. It's a breath of fresh air, and so I don't have to listen to those other guys anymore.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Right.
Good to hear from you, Jerry in Rutherford, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry, when you're on hold, can you hear the show before that?
Yes, I could hear you.
Okay, you can hear the show on hold. Okay, great. You had a comment about some of our singers.
Right. I was listening to a show this morning on the radio. I haven't heard the song, but they said that Neil Young, who sang with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young,
mm-hmm.
That he's got a new album out, and that the first song on the album is Let's Impeach the President.
Yeah, it's true. And in fact, the entire album is anti-Bush and or anti-war. I haven't heard it yet either. I think it's being released this week.
Oh, is that
so,
right?
So you got Neil Young for the old rockers. You got Merle Haggard for the old country western folks. Over at Jackson Brown's website, jacksonbrown.com, you can click on a new video remake of his piece, which I think is about 10 years old, his old song. Geez, I'm forgetting the title of it. I'd have to go back and look at my own website. But in any case, it's just a brilliant piece from Jackson Brown. And I mean, when music starts coming back out against you, I think you got a serious, serious kind of problem.
Also, my favorite, and I'd like to hear this as your background music sometime. My favorite is John Prine.
Okay. Well,
and he did a song in the last year or so, Some Humans Ain't Human.
Okay. We'll pass that along to Louise. She does our bumper music. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Skeeter in Shelburne, Vermont. Hey, Skeeter.
Hello, Tom. Welcome back to Vermont.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be on the air there.
Yeah. Regarding the new Merle Haggard song, I'm curious to know to find out what type of reaction the song is going to get from the country music fans.
Well, this is what Merle Haggard says in the last verse of the song, and you got to go on to his website, merlehaggard.com, and just look, because he looks right into the camera when he says it. He says, "You think I'm blowing smoke? I make 20 trips coast to coast every year." And then he winks at the camera. It's like, he says, "You think I'm blowing smoke? This is no joke. I make 20. I am convinced that he is reflecting, you know, the red America.
Yeah, but country music fans are a very conservative lot. I mean, look what happened to the Dixie Chicks.
The Dixie Chicks are back big time.
Yes, they are, but they're back primarily from non-country music fans.
I'm not sure that's the case.
They've crossed over to the pop field.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out, Skeeter. It's going to be real interesting to see how this thing shakes out.
Oh, yes, definitely. Thanks
a lot for the call. Jim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jim, we just have a few seconds left. Quick comment?
All right, real quick. I agree with you. The Vietnam War didn't start going down until somebody started singing about it.
Yeah, well, that's the canary in the mine. You know, it's in the mine shaft. It's like, you know, when pop music, when the culture, by the way, Lives in the Balance is the Jackson Browne song. When pop culture starts saying, hey, there's a problem, then you know that there's a real problem, particularly for a politician.
But what I called about primarily was here in our state and in many other states, people are stopping their faith, are quitting believing in. I should say no longer believing in their legislature, and they're starting to use the referendum and the initiative
to
get the work done that the legislatures won't do.
Yeah, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it shoots them in the foot. I can tell you that's certainly what happened here in Oregon, and we can talk about that more as the program goes on. Jim, thanks for raising an interesting subject. Coming up after the break, by the way, an amazing story about Alaska that may threaten life on Earth. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. That's named Jeff Guckert. In Alaska, lab reports discovered that several cruise passengers, this is from Think Progress, by the way, thinkprogress.org, several cruise passengers had suffered from an outbreak of bacteria. Now, that's like half the story. It's not unusual that people get sick from sometimes the food that is served on the ship, or, you know, bacteria that's floating around the ship. This is a shellfish bacteria that normally lives in shellfish. However, this is shellfish a bacteria that normally grows in much warmer waters. As the news report goes, the outbreak highlighted how surprisingly and directly global warming can affect human health, particularly in terms of infectious diseases. We're seeing in diseases traveling around the world. And, of course, this is another early warning, another early indicator of the consequences of global warming, the reality of global warming. Even as Lee Raymond, who just walked off with $400 million from ExxonMobil, just as Lee Raymond and ExxonMobil have worked so hard to fund these little right-wing groups and these few voices out there who are going, oh, there is no global warming, it's a debate, don't you know? Yeah, right. That's, by the way, The crime that Lee Raymond has committed, in my mind, at least the crime against the people of the United States and humanity, is not that he got a $400 million retirement package. It's that he supervised the promotion of the idea that there's no such thing as global warming for the better part of a decade, when I think everybody knew better, and I have to believe that he knew better. I mean, this is the equivalent of what the tobacco industry executives did. When the tobacco industry executives were running around saying, oh, you know, tobacco is not addictive. Tobacco, you know, there's nothing wrong with nicotine. It doesn't cause cancer, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's the tobacco industries themselves before Congress. You know.
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes. Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive. I believe that nicotine is not addictive. And I, too, believe that nicotine is not addictive.
Notice they all said believe. You say believe, you know, I believe the world is upside down. It doesn't make it so, and it doesn't make me a liar. Because all I'm doing is saying, you know, I believe that we're all supposed to be walking on the floor. Or on the roof, in the ceiling, or the ceiling, rather. I mean, you can just... So, in any case, that, I think, is the great crime of Lee Raymond, and that's the problem with this. We're seeing now also Bush riding roughshod over protected federal land. This is really meta to something much larger. This is a very interesting story. You go back and you look at what happened in Texas when George Bush was governor, and he converted most of the laws that had to do with emissions of toxins from factories, particularly from refineries and chemical companies and things like that. He modified these laws so that no longer did they require mandatory compliance, they became voluntary. And the result is that Texas is now, if not the, one of the two or three most heavily polluted states in the United States. Depending on how you define the criteria of pollution, whether it's, you know, toxins per person, toxins per square mile, or total toxins. In terms of total toxins, it's the most polluted state in the United States. Because once he made these things voluntary, all these companies said, oh, it's voluntary. We don't need to do this anymore. And the air got worse in Texas's cities, and you know, on it went. And people from Texas know this about George Bush. They know what's going on. So yesterday, Bush goes out to ride his mountain bike. He's got an addiction for exercise. Apparently replaced his addiction to alcohol. And he rode through the San, I think it's pronounced Jacinto, J-A-C-I-N-T-O, the San Jacinto Mountains National Monument. And there's this trail called the Clara Burgess Trail. And because the Park Service has done things the way Bush wants them done, there are 10 trails in this national monument, in this national park, where people should not ride mountain bikes during a period of time from the 1st of January until the 30th of June when the sheep who live there are lambing, the bighorn sheep, which is an endangered species. And they've got signs all over the place saying, please don't ride these trails from the first of the year until June 30th. But it's voluntary. You can you know, respect the sheep, or you can just ride your mountain bike. Because, you know, the Bush philosophy is make everything voluntary. So here George Bush, after he rides his bike through the National Wildlife Monument, after he ignores the voluntary avoidance guidelines at the monument, after he, you know, with a massive entourage, in all probability, we don't have photos of it, but generally wherever he rides, he's got SUVs following him and off-road vehicles coming along for the ride, complete with doctors and everything else. He says, I just spent some quality time in Congresswoman Mary Bono's district, and I forgot to tell you that I had the privilege of riding my mountain bike in the desert as well, the national monument that she helped put together to preserve open spaces. She's got a lot of humility. She didn't name the national monument after herself. If I were to name it, I would say Really Hard Bike Ride Monument. Great joke. Yeah, it was a really hard bike ride through an area that should be off limits. Apparently, they note over at Think Progress, apparently the White House is not involved in the Bureau of Land Management's comprehensive multi-agency planning effort to ensure the survival of the sheep. Nor are, you know, the other Bush agencies associated with efforts to ensure the survival of human beings here on planet Earth. By the way, the Department of Homeland Security has come out with a new document. This is unclassified, although it does say for official use only. Warning, this document is unclassified, official use only. It contains information that may be exempt from public release under the Freedom of Information Act. It is to be controlled, stored, handled, transmitted, distributed, and disposed of in accordance with DHS policy. Should I share it or not? I don't know. It's over at talkingpointsmemo.com. The headline, I'll tell you what, I won't read you the whole thing. I'll just share little bits of it with you. I think that way I'll be in compliance with the law. The headline, Preventing Attacks by Animal Rights Extremists and Eco-Terrorists. Yes, sure enough, if you're demonstrating, if you're protesting on behalf of the earth, you are now a terrorist. And I'm reading from the document. Attacks against corporations by animal rights extremists and eco-terrorists are costly to the targeted company and over time can undermine confidence in the economy. Well, that's certainly terrorist. Now, see, I thought the definition of terrorism was killing innocent people to produce terror that produces a political result. I thought you had to kill people to be a terrorist. Maybe I missed something. And in fact, they go on to say, although we have no specific credible information at this time, suggesting animal rights extremists and eco-terrorists are planning to target known corporations, etc. And then they say, you know, what are the tactics of these groups? A primary objective of animal rights and environmental extremists is to attack corporations that are perceived to operate contrary to the extremist ideology. They use non-invasive tactics, such as organizing protests and flyer distribution. You want to be a terrorist? According to the Department of Homeland Security, organize a protest. Pass out flyers. You are now a terrorist. They also seek to raise the cost of doing business by low-technology acts of vandalism, such as graffiti, or sending continuous faxes in order to drain the ink supply in company fax machines. No, I'm not making this up. You are a terrorist if you are draining the ink supply of a company fax machine by sending them faxes. Extremists may also obtain critical information about a targeted company. They may use this information to disclose corporate secrets. They may expose activities. They may reflect negatively on the company. Whoa. If so, you too can become a terrorist, according to the Department of Homeland Security. In fact, they give an example. Huntington Life Sciences. This group, they call it an extremist organization, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. They lobbied a company with what the Department of Homeland Security calls an email harassment campaign to drop holding in HLS's stock, and sure enough, they dropped the stock, and gee, I guess that's an act of terrorism. After the break, an update for the Washington, D.C. with the Talk Radio News Service, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
And you forgot.
There's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, Wanted, dead or alive.
Have you forgot?
We'll smoke him out of his cave. And we'll get him eventually.
Have you forgot?
Capture Bin Laden, kill him, and bring his head back in a box on dry ice.
Have you forgot?
Basically, the president botched the response to 9/11. He should have gone right after Bin Laden.
Have you forgot?
We should have focused on finding Bin Laden and demolishing Al-Qaeda.
Have you forgot?
Before going down and starting a war in Iraq.
Have you?
Why did we put all our military resources into Iraq, which was our number five security threat?
Have you forgotten?
Donald Rumsfeld said, there are no good targets in Afghanistan. Let's bomb Iraq.
Have you forgotten?
And we said, but Iraq had nothing to do with this. And that didn't seem to make much difference.
Have you forgotten?
Well, apparently George W. Bush has forgotten. Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Ellen.
Well, it's interesting. The president today came up with his gasoline issues, and he came out with sort of something for everyone. He was under a lot of pressure to talk about price gouging, except the conservatives are furious with him for doing this. So in that way, he sort of is leaning, or at least trying to sound more consumer-oriented. And then he wants to end oil and gas exploration tax breaks to the tune of about $2 billion over a period of 10 years. He wants to also do something in terms of alternative fuel vehicle promotion. I suppose, you know, he's trying to look green right around Earth Day here. But then he wants to have a temporary waiver of local environmental regulations, which would, of course, allow more refinery capacity. And he also wants to boost refinery capacity. And last but not least, just in case you thought he was getting a little liberal in the speech, he has a renewed push for ANWR. And, of course, what people never realize is you can drill all you want in ANWR, and that oil goes on the open market. It does not go to the good old USA.
Right, and in fact, it's more likely to end up in Japan.
Exactly.
Or China.
So that is happening. But as I said, some of the conservatives are angry about this price gouging issue that he talked about because they say, well, Bush has to at least look like he's being attentive on this price gouging issue.
Yeah. So all talk, no action. All hat, no
Well, war. We'll see. So far, all hat and no action. Yeah. Now, at the same time, the president today that he is announcing this unity government, there was an interesting press conference today. Carl Levin, Jack Reed, and Susan Collins said that they're going to introduce an amendment to the supplemental appropriations bill that's going to ask President Bush to tell the Iraqis that if they don't form in a government quickly, the U.S. is going to withdraw troops. And Collins said that she wants a reporting requirement on the status of the Iraqi unity government.
Do you think that's going to happen?
No.
Yeah.
Not a chance.
Mrs. Collins is a Republican.
A couple other interesting things. Isn't it interesting today that Jacob Kellenberger, he said that the detainees at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay are being treated better than they've been. He said, well, it doesn't mean there aren't any longer problems. But he also said that it's regrettable that the intense news media focus on Guantanamo distracts from other places such as Chechnya and other places. Well, unfortunately, they have the International Red Cross has suspended prison visits, but he's basically saying, well, that's distracting from it. I mean, I don't see how one focus on one thing distracts from anything else, and I don't understand why we shouldn't be focusing on Guantanamo. So there's also been a lot of talk about what's going on with Harriet Myers, and today Josh Bolton said that Harriet Myers is definitely going to be staying at the White House.
Oh, well, that's reassuring for all the Harriet Myers fans, both of them.
Right, exactly. the other thing is that Tony Snow is in very heavy negotiations, and they are saying that he would have a stronger voice and a bigger role in decision-making because they basically had Scott McClellan doing their talking,
right.
But he got absolutely no traction in terms of what this is about.
Now,
and I know for a fact that they started talking to Tony before they ever told Scott he was going.
Interesting. Now, Snow was a speechwriter for Reagan, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you know, he's it's
or maybe
it's
Bush won.
Maybe it was Bush won.
I think it was Bush won.
Yeah, okay. I listened to his program for a while yesterday, and I thought, this guy, I mean, he gave three different reasons in a row why the price of oil was going up, and each one contradicted the other one. He was not making any sense. It was amazing. But, you know, hopefully he's a little more articulate than Scotty. We'll see how it shakes out.
You got it.
Ellen Renner, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for being with us today.
Okay.
Talk to you later. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. After the break, Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State will explain the danger of tax preparers selling off your personal information. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We're wussies for war, wussies for war. We don't even know what the war is for, but we will expedite it if somebody else will fight it, cause we're gung-ho.
We won't go wussies for war.
Amazing. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Jim McDermott is with us. He's from the 7th District of the state of Washington, the 7th Congressional District, representing Burien, SeaTac, Seattle Shoreline, etc. Congressman McDermott, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Tom.
And I should note your website, McDermott, M-C-D-E-R-M-O-T-T, 4, F-O-R, Congress.com. And you have you've gotten on this issue here of taxpayer privacy. This is an interesting one. I can file my tax return with a private company, and that private company can then sell my tax information?
Yeah, we have left the door open for a long time for them to sell to affiliated organizations. They recently announced the rewriting of new regulations and said they could sell it to anybody as long as they got informed consent. So at that point, Pete Stark and I and several others said, hey, wait a minute, that we shouldn't be selling them at all. So the bill that we put in will prohibit the sale, period.
Do you think that there's any possibility that this is going to pass?
Well, you know, Americans, whether you're right-wing or left-wing or middle-wing or Democrat or Republican, everybody is a little bit paranoid about the IRS or any tax preparer, whether you're using H.R. Block or some private one, being able to sell your information to whomever they want just so they can make money. I mean, that's not what you think of when you're paying your taxes. You're paying your taxes to the government, not selling your information to somebody who may want to begin sending you a bunch of mail.
Isn't this, though, Congressman Jim McDermott, isn't this part of a larger assault on the commons and on the idea of government representing the people and purely? For example, a friend of mine who lives in Illinois recently had to get a second form of ID in order to open a bank account, so she decided to get a passport. In order to get the passport, she had to get a birth certificate. She contacted the state in which she was born, I believe it was Alabama, and they have outsourced to a private corporation the issuance of birth certificates. So she had to pay that private corporation $30, $40, $50, whatever it was, plus the fee that that corporation pays to the state in order to get her birth certificate. And oddly, all they wanted from her was a rent receipt. I mean, it was very strange. And so that she could then take the birth certificate to get the passport, right? And it's like, at what point do we say enough already? We're not going to be outsourcing all this stuff. We're going to, I mean, isn't this kind of symptomatic of the exact same thing like Halliburton delivering the mail in Iraq to the soldiers? And we had a woman here on the program about a year ago whose son was killed because Halliburton that week didn't want to deliver the mail. And so the soldiers had to go out to the airport because the road was being blown up, you know, by mm-hmm. IEDs and things. And her son died on that road and trying to get his mail.
Well, you're really putting your finger right on the whole issue. We have for a long time believed that there was an appropriate role for government, and it was protecting the people of the country. And we have continually eroded that under Republican administrations because they really don't believe that the government should have any protection or should be protecting at all. That's how you got this whole business of privatizing Social Security. It's all part of the same idea of getting rid of government. We don't need government. The private sector will take care of us. Well, the private sector will take care of you, all right. if it makes money for them. Otherwise, they're not interested. And that's really what you're seeing in very small form in this issue. And the ones you're describing are just more of the same.
Yeah, in fact, I would suggest that this assault on government, a government that we have had known as Americans since the founding of this country, was we the people, started with Ronald Reagan. When Reagan came along and he said...
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And that always got a laugh for him, but the people in New Orleans right now are not laughing.
Well, I think that's when we got a real quick and powerful view of what the result of this attitude really is. When we turn to the government in some time of real need and they're not there, and suddenly we say, well, where the hell is the government? Well, yeah. You just been trading away the government and being, you know, attacking government employees and acting as though none of them do anything. And then suddenly when something happens, it wasn't the people on the ground. It was the people at the top who simply didn't prepare for what was going on. And the public employees took a lot of guff for something that really wasn't their fault.
Yeah, and at the same time, you've got conservatives who are, or so-called conservatives. Barry Goldwater's got to be rolling over in his grave right now, and Dwight Eisenhower and Everett Dirksen. And in any case, you've got these guys saying that with FEMA, for example, they don't think it should be there. They think it should all be privatized, and so they, you know, so Bush breaks it, and then he stands around and says, "Hey, look at it, it's broken."
Yes, exactly. Well, that's the awfulness of what's gone on, is that the people who should have been held accountable for all this have managed to slip out of it and put the blame on people. Sure, there were things that didn't get done, but it was not totally, and first and foremost, it was not the problem of the people on the ground. It was the people in Washington, D.C. who simply weren't paying attention. The president went off to, you know, wherever he went just to have a good time, when the country's coming apart, the president has a responsibility to stay and protect us. Mm-hmm. And he just doesn't believe in that. He just thinks that, you know, it's all right to let people hang out. It's awful what happened on, and we haven't fixed it yet.
Yeah. So to bring this all back to this issue that's like the point issue that you and Pete Stark are going after here with the taxpayer privacy, is the solution that you're proposing one that addresses just this specific program or this specific problem of, you know, taxpayer records getting out there into the public domain and being a commodity basically for sale? Can you use that as kind of the nose under the camel's, or the camel's nose under the tent, you know, the edge of the tent, to get into this larger issue of let's take back our government, let's take back our public functions, let us begin restoring faith in our public institutions, or do you think this is just going to be limited right here because of the Republican majority?
Well, I think for the moment we're stuck, but I think that we grabbed it because we wanted people to recognize it's sometimes hard to get the public's attention until something awful has happened. Now, in this instance, we got it as soon as the information came out that they were rewriting the regulations and taking all the restrictions off except for you have to give your consent, and they could then sell it to anybody.
Right.
Well, we grabbed that because these things are happening all the time. And unless we make an issue out of it some way, either by raising it in the press or in the radio or putting a bill in or something, it just goes through, and then people wake up 5 weeks or 5 months or 5 years down the road and say, how in the world did this happen? Well, it started today, and there's no way you can let this go on. You must react to it immediately.
Congressman Jim McDermott from Washington's 7th Congressional District. One quick question, sir, before you go,
sure.
if you still have a minute or two.
Yep.
I think we have about three, actually, on this end. I was in Seattle a couple of years ago, heard you speak against the war, before the war started, actually. And you had been over to Iraq and came back and said, you know, this isn't the right thing to do. Time has proven you right. We see now that Pat Roberts is suggesting that the investigation into whether, you know, how the Bush administration handled pre-invasion intelligence should be split into two parts, the political part, you know, basically being put on hold forever. It's like the Intelligence Committee has become the cover-up committee. Do you see this logjam breaking, either in the House or the Senate, in anytime soon?
If we have what I think is developing in this country now, and that is a major shift in political control, that is, if the Democrats take over, you're going to see a series of investigations open up on a whole bunch of issues, from secret prisons to Guantanamo to Halliburton's oil contracts to a whole series of things, including the intelligence. This business of blaming what went on in Abu Ghraib at 6 or 8 young people down at the bottom of the command chain is just simply nonsense. Anybody who's ever been in the military, and I served, knows that they didn't do that without having some people on top knowing what was going on and allowing it to go on.
Yeah,
and that has to be brought out. The Republicans will never bring it out until they have lost control of the House.
Yeah, those people didn't get on an airplane with a dog leash out of Seattle or something. You know, it wasn't their idea. And John Dean, Richard Nixon's White House counsel, suggests that so many people in the Bush administration could go to jail as a result of the investigations you're talking about, that Bush will do an October surprise of some sort this fall in order to maintain a Republican majority. Are you anticipating, and your peers, is there talk about that in the House?
My feeling is that we are going to invade Iraq. Probably from the air.
Iran, you mean?
Iran. Believing that we can do from 20,000 or 40,000 feet what we would not dare to do on the ground. I think we're going to do that as a way of simply scaring people to death and winding up with trying to scare people again as they did in the last election to keep control. I think people have to be aware of that. We're going to fight it here on the floor, but people ought to be talking to the members of Congress about it.
Good on you, sir. Congressman Jim McDermott, McDermott for FORCongress.com, the website, representing Washington's 7th Congressional District, where we're on the air on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Congressman McDermott, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Talk to you again.
Indeed. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first.
There you go, that's what we got to be working on, my friends. Rebuild America first.
Let's go.
Seems like a fine plan to me. Merle Haggard's new song, MerleHaggard.com. Check it out. Amazing video. Here's a little.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it the most. You think I'm blowing smoke? Boys, it ain't no joke. I make 20 trips a year from coast to coast.
There you go. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. State legislators in Illinois and California have introduced resolutions to initiate impeachment proceedings against Vice President Cheney and President Bush. They're doing this under the Jefferson Manual of Rules for the U.S. House of Representatives. In Vermont, Representative David Zuckerman plans to introduce a similar resolution this week. In Pennsylvania, State Senator Jim Furlow is collecting signatures on petitions calling for Congress to launch an impeachment inquiry. 11 cities and towns have already passed resolutions calling for impeachment. In other signs that impeachment is becoming a national movement, this is a note, by the way, from David Swanson. Tip of the hat to Dave for that. Congresswoman Maxine Waters will speak at a major forum on impeachment at the California Democratic Party convention in Sacramento on April 29th. Along with leading constitutional scholars, impeachment activists, and California Assemblyman Paul Koretz. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor to President Carter from 77-81 and a well-known hawk, wrote in the L.A. Times that an attack on Iran would be an impeachable offense. What would that make? Number 17. The Los Angeles Times urged President Bush to fire Vice President Cheney. That, by the way, one of the October surprises that John Dean has actually predicted. He said that in October, there's a good chance Bush will replace Cheney. Cheney will step down because of health considerations, and Bush will replace him with somebody who will have the, you know, a new face for the Republican Party, Rudy Giuliani or John McCain or somebody like that. Watergate reporter Carl Bernstein in Vanity Fair called for a bipartisan investigation of Bush. 60 Minutes broke an explosive story that Saddam's foreign minister told the CIA that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction 6 months before we invaded Iraq. Neil Young, creating a tremendous buzz in the music world with his new album, Let's Impeach the President, or his new song, on an album all about that. Red Hot Chili Peppers bass player Flea called for Bush's impeachment on the band's website. Ed Asner did a public service announcement for AfterDowningStreet.org, urging Congress to investigate possible crimes. And Viggo Mortensen, the star of Lord of the Rings, joined a long list of congressional candidates, scholars, and activists as a member of a Citizens Impeachment Committee. That's at ImpeachPack.org. So a lot going on in a lot of states. Pretty amazing what happens when people say, hey, enough already. We're taking this in our own hands. BJ in University Place, Washington on the line. Our number 1-866-440-8466. Hey, BJ, what's up?
Good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm great.
After Bush's announcement today about the oil and how he's going to bring the gas prices down, I see it, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I see it as a huge win for the gas companies. As soon as they reduce the environmental regulations, that's the biggest part. Everything else is kind of, yeah, the conservatives are pissed off, but he said that they're going to reduce the environmental standards.
Right.
That's
just,
what these gas companies have been after from day one.
Oh, yeah. He just announced this, and this is going to be tremendously – it's going to tremendously enhance their profits.
Yeah, and that's
bottom line.
Every time they've had any hearings with these oil companies, they've always said it's these environmental standards that are driving up gas prices, especially during the summer. And now, once again, I mean, I think people have caught on to it as big, but this is a big win for them. They're going to increase their profits, and it's going to drive down gas prices a little bit. I guess June profits, they just said the forecast is just went down 8 cents, but it's going to drive up their profits again. They're going to hit record numbers again this year.
Yeah, good point, BJ. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. This Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, Democrat from New Jersey, says, if we were simply to repeal gratuitous tax breaks for rich oil companies and use the money to pay for a 60-day holiday on the federal gas tax, gas prices would go down by about 18 cents. Now, first of all, that sounds to me like a nutty idea. We should be reducing the price of gas. I think that we should certainly reduce or repeal the gratuitous tax breaks on the rich oil company. Sure. We gave them, what, $8 billion in the energy bill this Dick Cheney worked out with the oil companies in secret, such a secret that he had to go to the Supreme Court to protect the secrecy of who attended the meetings. But what this also tells us is that the federal gas tax is 18 cents. Now, if the 18-cent tax was passed back when gas was selling for 25, 30, 40 cents a gallon, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. But, boy, I just don't get it how Carter, for example, Jimmy Carter understood the situation. Why didn't they convert the gas tax from a fixed amount to a percentage? I mean, it's such a small percentage right now. If it's 18% and gas is at $3 a gallon, it's, what does that make it, 7-8%, something like that? I can't do math quite that fast in my head, but it seems like it would be in that neighborhood. And if that's the case, no, it would be less than half of that, wouldn't it? It would be 4.5-5%. In any case, whatever the gas tax is, let's convert it to a percentage right away so that if the oil companies take the price of gas up to $5 a gallon, the federal government will have a little more money so that in this reserve that they can then use to lessen the impact of this, particularly on truckers. You know, let's help people convert to different fuels. Let's help them, you know, move to more fuel-efficient engines. Let's build a public transportation infrastructure in this country. Let's build our railroads. After the break, we're going to get down to business with Code Pink's Jody Evans in our Bioneers segment. Stick around for that. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 57 minutes past the hour, in the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. A clean and free vote, you know, that would be nice too. We'll be back.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Their website, Bioneers.org. Our Bioneers guest this week, Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink. Their website, CodePinkAlert.org. Jody Evans, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you here with us, Jody. Just to give people an overview, Code Pink, Women for Peace, and author of Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism, social and political organizer for over 30 years, oversaw then-Governor Jerry Brown's Office of Appropriate Technology, later ran his presidential campaign. You've been doing this for a while. This goes on and on, all the things you've been involved with. Good on you. It's a real activist here. You visited Iran last year. You visited Iraq before our first this most recent war. What's your take on how Iran is perceiving what's going on right now?
Well, when I went to Iran, it was exactly this time last year, and again in the news was Bush thinking of invading or dropping bombs. So I went and asked everyone I met the question, we're about to bomb your country, what do you think about that? And to a person, I got about the same response. You know, they don't like their government for domestic policies, but if they were bombed, they would back it 100%. Better the devil you know than you don't. But the thing that was interesting is comparing it to Iraq. Iraq is a country of 25 million people that we had so damaged with sanctions that it was hobbling by the time we went there before the invasion 3 years ago. Iran is much stronger because of the war between Iraq and Iran. It's a country of like 60 million. At any given time, there are 5 million people in the military, probably 5 to 10 million because it's mandatory. And also, the population, 60% of the population is under the age of 25. Because of that war. So it's a very, very different country. They all pointed out that it's a country that's never invaded another country.
In the whole history, the Persian history and everything else?
That's their story.
What about, wasn't Darius the Great the Persian conqueror back in the...
Well, I'm telling you their story.
Okay,
I'm telling
all right.
This is their story.
Right.
And they're the same as what I saw when I went to Iraq. The pride of the Iraqi is the same as the pride of the Persian.
Mm-hmm.
They love their country. It's deep history. They know their history. It's a devotion that's quite powerful that we saw when we first went to Iraq where, you know, many of the people we said, you know, if you invade, this will be your grave because we'll all die before we're occupied by the United States.
Yeah.
And you see that. The same in Iran, what happened in Yugoslavia when you invade, you drive people to support a leader that they don't want to support because they need to bond together. Probably, you know, what Bush is thinking, because if we invade, then his numbers will go up.
Yeah, well, it's and in fact, we just were talking with Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State, and he. Suggested that, in his opinion and that of many others in Congress, that this is what Bush is going to do, and he's going to do it as an October surprise.
Yeah, we're definitely hearing from people in the military that they've been told they're going out in September for a mission in late September or October.
Yeah, Yeah, just in time for, I frankly think it'll backfire. But what Americans don't get, and I think that we all need to just imagine this for a moment. I mean, I suspect, Jody, I don't know where you would stand on this, but I'll just give you my take on it. I have a lot of respect for Canada, the Canadian people, and the Canadian government. And if the Canadian government next week was to, the leader of Canada was to say, those Americans, they have weapons of mass destruction, they're operating torture centers around the world, they're misbehaving in the public arena, so we're going to begin bombing them. And they started dropping bombs on New York City and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Portland and San Francisco. And then, said, now after we bombed you with shock and awe, we're going to invade and we're going to occupy your country so that we will, overthrow this madman who's running your country.
Oh, yeah, but don't forget, Tom, and then we're going to rewrite your laws.
That's right.
So that everyone in the world,
so that only
you can own your country and the resources of your country. And we're going to write the law so that everyone else can have jobs in your country and you can't.
Right. And Canadian companies are going to come in and run everything.
Right.
And if that were to happen, as much as I like Canada and as much as I dislike George W. Bush, I would be inclined to take up arms against the occupying Canadian army.
Except maybe the part about the Canadian companies would come in and run everything.
it might be a good thing. But I don't think that Americans... We have never been invaded in this country, and I think that's one of the reasons, or never been successfully invaded anyway. I mean, the British tried in the War of 1812, but I think that that's one of the, and we have no, institutional memory of that, frankly. I think that that's one of the reasons why Europeans look at our behavior and, right down to the school children wince, because they have, a memory of what invasion means. And I don't think the average American has the ability to generate empathy for folks who we are invading.
No, it's meaningless. You're right. There's no experience of it, so it's just words.
We can't imagine it.
And that's why Bush is able to use just words to manipulate their thinking.
Yeah. Change topics a little bit. You were one of the people arrested for busting up the Republican National Convention when Bush was speaking. What happened there?
We have this campaign called Pink Slip Bush in America. You get a pink slip when you're fired, and he's done so many things that should have him fired, but we pick on, just the fact that he's lied is enough. And so each night a different person from Code Pink would go in and disrupt the convention. And I pulled the straw for Bush, so I went in. I found a place where I felt the least security was around. I took off my jacket and pulled down this pink slip I had on that said, "Bush, you lied, you're fired, and bring the troops home from Iraq now and in the occupation." And June Braceras, another member of Code Pink, was on the other side of Bush. So she got up on a chair and started saying, out of the war now. And I got up at the same time. Well, she was causing such a disruption that I got to stand for about 5 minutes.
Wow.
Before the guards that were already on me, they had been on me since I walked in, turned around and saw that I was there, and then they just, ripped me out, dragged me, stepped on my foot, lost my shoes, left my purse behind, and dragged me out quite angry.
Mm-hmm. And
best part, Tom, was that after sitting outside the White House for 5 months, Code Pink did a vigil for 5 months, mm-hmm. I actually got to, he stopped speaking and had to pause, and that's the closest we'd ever gotten to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I really suspect that he has so little ability to empathize that it's going to take a lot to get his attention. I'm curious what your thoughts are. We're talking with Jody Evans, the co-founder of Code Pink, the website codepinkalert.org. And I'm curious, Jody, if you have an opinion or thoughts on why it is that so many people came out into the streets prior to Iraq. It was like the Vietnam protests all over again, or the civil rights marches. And yet there hasn't been much of anything since then.
Well, there's a couple of things that happened. First of all, I think we think that that's all you have to do, that, if we just get in the streets and yell a little, the power will give up power. Power relinquishes power not easily. And it's a long struggle, you know, it's a long pull down of getting the truth out into the mainstream over and over and over again, which, thank you, you do constantly, by telling the stories and reframing the lies, by really getting people to see the cost of this to themselves. Like you said earlier, they don't know what that means to be invaded, so what is the cost of war? How is it affecting your community? Why should you do this? And then the confusion people feel. Well, we invaded, so, I mean, even I run up against this, we just brought six Iraqi women to the United States and they toured, and I saw that even people who are anti-war still have that confusion of that, well, maybe it would be better if we stayed. You run into that all the time.
Yeah.
And even though it's so, for, you know, we look at it, and for me it's so common sense that the only thing we can do is get out. The only thing we can do is give the Iraqis back their country, that we are only creating, you know, hell on earth for them.
Yeah.
People still don't get that. And so in that confusion, people stay home, or, you know, or they don't want to risk their jobs, or they don't want to really do what it takes to end a war. You know, when you think of soldiers go and put their lives on the lines, what are we doing?
Yeah, and we have to get involved. We have to get active. Jody Evans, the co-founder of Code Pink, codepinkalert.org, the website. Jody, pass my greetings along to Medea and Kevin, too, if you would. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I see the stars and stripes outside the courthouse door, and I wonder every night who it stands for anymore. They say that it's gonna be cheaper to make them in China. They'll stitch them and ship them back here in some big ocean liner. They say that it's gonna be cheaper to make them in China. But what's to become of this small town in South Carolina?
Well, they're just toast. I mean, that's just the bottom line. The small town in South Carolina, the small town in Michigan, the small town in California, the small town in Texas, they're toast. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just wanted to wrap up this thing that we started the program with, the discussion about the idea of a second Bill of Rights. This is such an important concept. I don't want to just, you know, let it not be finished. It's Franklin Roosevelt in 1944, his last State of the Union address. He had just been reelected as President of the United States. He would be dead within the year. He was winning the war in Europe and Japan. World War II. He was winning World War II. And, you know, the final months of World War II. And his January 11th State of the Union address to the nation, he laid out this second Bill of Rights. And he said, the second Bill of Rights includes the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation. In other words, you can take a vacation. You can eat. No more hunger in America. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a decent price. The right of every business person, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. And the right to a good education. Now, the conservatives have a somewhat different take on this. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, Jody Evans, who was just with us from Code Pink, codepinkalert.org, wanted me to mention, on May 14th, Mother's Day, at the White House, there will be a 24-hour vigil that Code Pink is, I'm not sure if they're organizing it or taking part in it, but you can learn more about it at codepinkalert.org. And you know, they're asking people to participate and just know about it. 24 hours, May 14th, the White House. Now, the conservatives suggest that laissez-faire economics, that you know, so-called free market economics, can only function or mean that because the government has, because there are what are called negative rights in the Constitution. For example, you have the right to have freedom from government interference, freedom of speech, freedom from the government preventing you from speaking, freedom of assembly, freedom from the government preventing you from assembling, freedom, you know, freedom of privacy, freedom from the government in, intruding into your privacy. For example, that these are what the cons call negative rights. They say these are things where the government can't do anything. But the reality is that these are all areas where the government must do something. These are actually affirmative or positive rights. The government is mandated that it must prevent itself from reading our mail, listening to our phone calls. It must pass laws that enforce that. And those laws have to be passed by the legislature, and they have to be on the books, and they have to be positive and proactive. And there have to be police departments and FBI, things like that, that will enforce those laws by the government, against the government, to protect we the people from the government. And there must be courts in which those laws can be adjudicated. And there must be jails where politicians who break those laws, or members of the any employee of the government who breaks those laws, can go to jail. That these must be there. So this is the government taking an active role. This is active liberty, to paraphrase Stephen Breyer, the United States Supreme Court Justice. This is the government taking a proactive role. All of these so-called negative rights actually require government in order to exist. So it's not a stretch to say, therefore, we can say also that there are what are sometimes referred to as the positive rights, the right to a job. And if private industry won't provide that job, government will, as Roosevelt did during with the Works Progress Administration, with the WPA and the Civilian Conservation Corps of the CCC and other programs. That there is a right to a reasonable level of pay. That there is a right to unionize. That there is a right to universal health care. That you have the right to have a retirement safe and from the fears of old age or sickness. That you should be free from the fear of unemployment. And this is what Roosevelt laid out in 1944 in his State of the Union address in January of 1944. He said, this is the new Bill of Rights, the new American Revolution. And in my opinion, it's time for us to pick that mantra up again and go back and say, you know, FDR had it right. Franklin Roosevelt had it right. And we do want a new Bill of Rights. And we do want to move forward. Did I say Reagan? I may have. I meant Roosevelt. I'm sorry. And we do need to pick up this Bill of Rights and go forward with it. After the break, are Reagan's Iran-Contra group back in the White House? You're not going to believe this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Forgotten flag and country and all it signifies. Across a foreign land he fought, too young to question why. Forgotten flag and country, as precious as a prayer. He didn't know a thing about the fools who sent him there.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Back on the 20th of April, Larissa Alexandrova wrote in Raw Story an article, the headline, Cheney has tapped Iranian expat arms dealer to surveil discussions with Iran, officials say. She writes, the Department of Defense and Vice President Dick Cheney have retained the services of Iran-Contra arms dealer and discredited an intelligence asset, I believe it's pronounced Manukar Gorbanifar, as their man on the ground in order to report on any interaction and attempts at negotiations between Iranian officials and U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, current and former intelligence officials say. And so, in other words, Cheney and Rummy have hired this guy, Gorbanifar, to monitor our ambassador to Iraq. and make sure he doesn't talk to Iran. What's the deal? So I immediately said, I recognize this name, and I've either talked with Barbara Honegger about it or read about it in her book, October Surprise, Did the Reagan-Bush Election Campaign Sabotage President Carter's Attempts to Free the American Hostages in Iran? One of the finest books, I can't tell you, you've got it. There are used copies floating around the web. Get a copy of this book, October Surprise by Barbara Honegger. She, in 1980, following her experience as a research assistant at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, she joined the research policy team of the Reagan-Bush campaign. In 1980, she was part of the Reagan-Bush presidential transition team. In 81, she worked in the White House Office of Policy Development as a research and policy analyst, later worked with the Department of Justice, and then later became a whistleblower and wrote the book that told the story of the October Surprise. Barbara Honegger, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you on again, Barbara.
Great to be here, Tom.
Pardon?
Great to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Tell me, you know, let's get into this story. Who is it Manuher Gorbanifar?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, but I've heard that it's Manuher Gorbanifar.
Okay, Manuher Gorbanifar. Who is this guy, and why have we hired him to watch Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador to Iraq?
Well, Manuher Gorbanifar, for those who remember anything about the Iran-Contra scandal, the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal, will remember that Manuher Gorbanifar was the ultimate disinformation agent who worked with Michael Ledeen and Oliver North and company to arrange the secret and illegal arms shipments to Iran.
This is in 86, right?
That is in the mid-1980s, yes. The first big meeting was in April-May period of 1986. That's correct.
And this was presumably part of the payoff for Iran having held the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election and Bush and Reagan would become vice president and president.
Well, that particular meeting probably wasn't. However, the Iran arms sales that surfaced in the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal were indeed the tip of the iceberg of just a few hundreds of millions of dollars of illegal arms shipments to Iran. That were just the tip of the iceberg of literally billions that started flowing right after Reagan took the oath of office.
Right, which was the payoff.
Which in turn was the payoff,
yeah.
The earlier shipments.
So why have we hired a guy who was a neocon or Ollie North? I mean, this was before the word neocon was being used.
A neocon man, literally, yes.
Yeah, the Karl Rove of the Middle East, I guess, you know, a disinformation specialist, Manuher Gorbanifar. Why have we hired him to watch over our ambassador? Now, Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador to Iraq, has his own weird history with Osama bin Laden, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. According to what I believe is a authoritative summary on the internet of the background of Mr. Khalilzad, who, by the way, was our first ambassador to Afghanistan just before becoming our ambassador to Iraq,
mm-hmm.
which he is today. Mr. Khalilzad, according to this bio, was a personal liaison to Osama bin Laden himself during the Soviet period in Afghanistan,
basically
a bagman.
This was back when bin Laden was our guy. He was working
That's
for us.
That's correct, when bin Laden was our man in Afghanistan, correct.
To throw the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
So Mr. Khalilzad knows Mr. bin Laden personally.
Not a good thing.
Not a good thing. And you ask the question, why would we hire Mr. Gorbanifar? It's very interesting. To me, what it says is, if true, what it says is that Condoleezza Rice, obviously Khalilzad is a U.S. ambassador and reports to Rice, the Secretary of State. This implies to me that Cheney and Rumsfeld do not trust Rice and or do not trust Rice and Khalilzad. In other words, they put Gorbanifar, their spy and disinformation agent con man, to watch Rice's man, Khalilzad.
So they brought Ollie North's old guy in to watch over Condi Rice and her person. That's
right.
Very interesting. That's very
yes,
interesting.
It is.
And what are they watching over? Is this like set up for the bombing of Iran in September or October? Or is this, you know, what are they trying to keep secrets from leaking? I mean, what's why?
Well, you're asking for an educated guess.
Yeah.
But I have reason to believe that the plan, whether it is ever whether it is actually carried out or not, that the plan to take military action, at least covert military action against Iran, has been part of the plan since before Bush even became president.
Just like the invasion of Iraq was.
Exactly. So the next domino to fall, as it were.
Right. This is all establish a footprint in the Middle East. Take the, well, Iran, when we invaded Iraq back, you know, what, 3 years ago now, Dick Cheney was running around, you know, talking about the amount of oil in Iraq and all that kind of thing. I mean, here's
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And now they're saying Iran sits on top of the second largest oil reserves in the world, 10% of the world's, you know, second only to Saudi Arabia. And
yeah,
Iraq
right.
doesn't have quite as much as we thought.
Right, right. And you've noticed that the Iraqi oil that was supposed to be flowing like a spigot and paying for this occupation and reconstruction hasn't materialized.
Yeah.
And now we have a broken record. They're saying exactly the same things about Iran as they did Iraq pre-invasion of Iraq.
And Bush actually thinks, apparently, I've talked to several people now in the military and people who are talking to people in the federal government who say that apparently the guys in the Bush administration, you know, Josh Bolton, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, they really think that the American people will, if they bomb Iran, if they start a war with Iran, will rally around the president.
I think that's absurd.
I think it's absurd, too, but do you think that they think that?
No, I don't think that they think that. I think they don't give a damn.
So why invade Iran?
Excuse me?
So why invade Iran?
Well, it's not clear that they intend to invade Iran in any conventional sense. I mean, as you probably know and have already told your listeners, there are a number of reports that U.S. covert operations, special forces, et cetera, are already on the ground in Iran.
Yes, just as they were in Iraq before we invaded Iraq.
Exactly. Exactly. So depending upon what the game plan is, unless it's blocked or stopped by concerted and organized citizen action, the plan may be focused on covert operations, which often include sabotage operations.
Interesting. We're talking, by the way, with Barbara Honegger. She's the author of October Surprise, a book that came out many years ago and is still, in my opinion, one of the very finest books. Not just one of the very finest books written in the last couple of decades, but certainly the best overview of the Reagan-Bush election campaign sabotage efforts against Jimmy Carter's presidency.
By the way, Tom,
successful. Yes, yes, Barbara.
I would just like to mention for your listeners, I think it's very important and interesting that Michael Ledeen has a long history of being directly and personally linked to Monitor Garbanifar.
Right.
For instance,
now, who is Michael Ledeen, broadly, for our listeners?
Well, that's very interesting. Michael Ledeen is a member of the Piniac cabal, the Pearl, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld.
Project for a New American Century, PNAC.
Yes, the Project for a New American Century, the people who called for a new Pearl Harbor before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, 9/11 was then called the new Pearl Harbor by George Bush himself the day
in his
9/11.
Diary.
Yeah. In his diary. So Michael Ledeen has also been called, in articles on the Internet about his background, he's been called Karl Rove's Karl Rove. In other words, he is an advisor to Karl Rove, God help us. Michael Ledeen has been personally linked in operations, disinformation operations, with Monitor Garbanifar going all the way back to the Iran-Contra period. So this is nothing new, and as your readers who have been following the New York Times coverage, etc., they already know that a number of top officials from the current Bush-Cheney administration met with, from the Pearl-Ledeen PNAC cabal, run essentially out of the Vice President Cheney's office in the Pentagon.
Amazing.
They have Barbara,
can I ask you to hold for just a minute, and we can wrap this up on the other side of this break? We have to take a commercial break here. Can you stick around? We're talking with Barbara Honegger. She's the author of October Surprise. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann radio program, The True People's Radio.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
It started with the factories where sulfur coal was burned. The atmosphere cried dirty tears, but no one was concerned. Exploding populations, turning wetlands into malls. People drove their Hummers without any kilt at all. Who will be the one? Who will be the one who feels that precious liquid rolling down their thirsty tongue? Who will be the one? What will it be worth? The one who drinks the final drop of water on the earth.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. We're talking with Barbara Honegger. She's the author of October Surprise, a book that has been out of print for quite some time, but you can still find used copies floating around the Internet. It's about the Reagan-Bush election campaign's attempts to sabotage Jimmy Carter's attempts to free the American hostages in Iran, and thus Reagan-Bush's efforts to... successful efforts, I should say, to win the election in 1980, and a brilliant book. Barbara, do you have is there a website or is there any good source, resource for people who want to just kind of get back into your book and this kind of stuff?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Consortium News, I believe it's .org. That's uh-huh. Bob Perry's website. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah.
Robert Perry.
Yep.
On Bob Perry's website, Bob Perry published the third book on October Surprise. Mine was the first. 3 years later, Gary Six, by the same title, October Surprise.
Right.
And about the same time, a little after, Robert Perry, former top reporter for UPI and Newsweek. In fact, Bob Perry broke the Iran-Contra affair scandal in Newsweek. Bob Perry published a book called Trick or Treason, the October Surprise Mystery, in which he also confirmed the October Surprise, working with Brian Ross of ABC News.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bob Perry's website, Consortium News, I believe it's .org, could be .net, could be .com, there go to the October Surprise X files, that's X hyphen files, and read the formerly classified documents that the House October Surprise investigation classified and hid away, but were then leaked out to Bob Perry, and he's now got them on the Internet, proving the October Surprise.
Great, great, marvelous. Now, back to what we were talking about here, where we have...
You need to speak up.
Sure, I'm sorry. Back to what we were talking about here, Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador to Iraq, according to one former intelligence source speaking to Larissa Alexandrova at Rod Story, said he has been authorized to enter into discussions with Iran over the stability inside Iraq. Now, we have a largely Shia government coming into control of Iraq. Is it possible, Barbara Honegger, that instead of setting up an attack on Iran, that instead we are setting up Iran to essentially take over Iraq in a way that, if it's stable and they keep out of our hair, that's fine. You know, it's sort of like we always said, the guy may be an SOB, but he's our SOB about our various dictators. I mean, that's what we said about Saddam Hussein up until 1991.
Well, you're asking for an informed opinion. I don't think so. I really think this administration, in particular Vice President Cheney, is apoplectic about Iran. I think that they really are against this Iranian regime. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's fake.
So Ghorbanifar, where has Ghorbanifar been for the last 25 years or so?
Well, as I mentioned before your last break, and perhaps that got cut off, so I'll just repeat it briefly in summary. Monitor Ghorbanifar has been reported in the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., as having met with Richard Perle,
Larry Franklin, the Iran expert from the DIA that was on loan to fight the number three guy at the Pentagon under Rumsfeld, meeting with these people on Iran, on intelligence about Iran and Iraq in the run-up to the Iran-Iraq war. And, in fact, Ghorbanifar and Shalabi were the two main sources of disinformation about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction.
So we're back to Chalabi, but Chalabi is also very, very tight with Iran, and Ghorbanifar is tight with Iran. I mean, it's...
Yes, they both are. Ghorbanifar was born in Iran.
So why would we bring him into an operation to overthrow... Well, I guess just because somebody's from a country doesn't mean that they're loyal to it.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
I said, I guess just because somebody's from a country doesn't mean that they're loyal to it. I mean, Ghorbanifar was born in Iran. Still, he's our guy working for us. Is that the deal?
Well, it depends upon who you mean by us. But it's clear that Mr. Ghorbanifar is working for the PNAC neocon... Conman cabal.
So yes. These guys have not been discredited. Wolfowitz is now head of the World Bank. The rest of them still have positions of power. It sounds like what you're saying, Barbara Honegger, is that the Project for New American Century, the neocons, are still running U.S. foreign policy.
Yes, they are, and Mr. Ghorbanifar is their man.
And he's helping organize this stuff within the Bush administration. Remarkable.
Well, he's essentially, as the article said, and I believe it's true, is a spy for these people. Yes, and what's interesting is he's a spy for the Cheney Rumsfeld Pearl Wolfowitz cabal against Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State's man in Iraq.
Now, Condi Rice has a lot of personal loyalty from and to George W. Bush. Is Bush the odd man out in this thing?
Well, what it feels like to me is there may be a difference of opinion between the office of the president and the office of the vice president.
Hmm. And in that collision, it seems that probably the office of the vice president would win. Hard to say, right?
That remains to be seen.
Indeed.
He certainly won out in the first
with regard to Iraq, yeah.
Operation on Iraq, yes.
Absolutely. Barbara Honegger, thanks so much for being with us. Her book, October Surprise, track down a used copy. You can find it. It's marvelous. Barbara Honegger. Coming up on the next Tom Hartmann program, I'll be asking conservative David Tebow if China represents a potential threat to America. Why have presidents since Nixon sucked up to them? That and more and your calls right here on the Tom Hartmann program tomorrow. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.